Hello and welcome to the Miko Bits Show, and I'm your host, Miko Bits. And today we have an exciting show prepared for you. This is Barney from Vega Protocol, which is an exciting project related to DeFi derivatives. So really exciting topic. We'll get pretty geeky, I think, and looking forward to hearing from Barney. So Barney, welcome to the Miko Bits Show.
Great to be here.
Yeah, terrific. So first and foremost, I guess would love to just get straight into, you know, what problem is Vega solving?
Sure. So, I mean, the key problem we're solving is having a sort of decentralized way of trading and creating more advanced products with a lifetime, like derivatives. So, you know, Bitcoin and Ethereum and assets like ERC-20s are all very well and decentralized. But as we all know, the financial system kind of consists of these products, which actually make up a huge amount of the trading volume and what goes on in finance. And we believe that for Bitcoin and other digital assets to be successful in a decentralized environment, you also need a decentralized financial system of other products and derivatives around that. And that's what Vega's aiming to solve.
Yeah, I think it's especially a very pressing problem because in the news recently, we saw the CFTC complaint against CZ and Binance, right? So, you know, so centralized exchanges are definitely under some extreme regulatory pressure. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about the CFTC issue with Binance, and you know, how does that affect things like decentralized derivatives exchange?
Yeah, I think it's I think it's sort of on one level, it's an attempt of regulators to bring unregulated things going on globally in digital assets under various regulatory purviews, and to try and sort of apply rules, and that can be problematic for all kinds of reasons. You know, even if it's just the kind of extrajudicial application of rules. But on the other hand, I think it's symptomatic of a problem, which is in centralized finance, you sort of need regulation because everything is a black box and you can't see what's happening. So if you're to trust a centralized exchange or a centralized financial product, you really need to know that there's some reason to do so. And kind of the rule of law and contracts and regulation are the things that give you that ability to have trust. And as you know, this sort of old crypto phrase goes, don't trust, verify. When we come to decentralized systems, what we're actually aiming to do is say, you don't need those sort of mechanisms of trust. What you need is transparency, public open code, and you know, time and many eyes on the protocols and on what's going on, so that you can replace the need to trust regulators and all of those things with the ability to verify on chain. And so I think it's super important to kind of realize that I think the situation we have with these kind of semi-regulated or unregulated exchanges in the crypto world is probably a temporary situation. You're probably going to end up either with things that are pretty fully regulated or things that are very difficult to trust at all in the long run. And so I think, you know, the decentralized finance ability to move in there and provide truly permissionless, open and transparent global systems to kind of replace the centralized systems is going to be a really important part of the maturing and development of the crypto space.
Yeah, this is definitely music to my ears. If you go to my personal website, miko.com, you'll see on the front, it says open source financial infrastructure will make the world more consensual, fair, just, inclusive, transparent, and innovative, right? So I think that what you're describing is basically just that, right? Which is effectively that through the principles and processes of kind of global transparency, you know, what you'll have is actually just a much better financial system, right? And in a sense, like, I think that the problematic nature of the structure of finance today is that it creates these kind of like too big to fail entities, right? And obviously, one of the things that's super complex about regulatory compliance is really that it raises the cost of participation. So for example, if you look at today's banking system in the United States, the cost of participation is so high that really it's looking like regional banks aren't a thing anymore, right? That actually fully, there was one service provider that has a bunch of startups as banks. And, you know, what happened during the SVB collapse is that it turns out that 50% of their customers who changed banks changed to JP Morgan. Right. And, you know, so that's a pretty big percentage, you know, and so in a sense, like the regulatory regime really optimizes for creating banks that are too big to fail.
Right? I think so. I think banking is becoming or has always been perhaps a utility. You know, you can't. There was an article interviewing some wine growers in the California region. They were like, what, you expect us to look at the balance sheet of our bank and tell you, decide if it's going to fail? I mean, that doesn't work. And you need a bank to operate in the modern world. So really, banking is this kind of like quasi-governmental utility, semi-operated by the state, but actually operated by a bunch of people. And whenever they take too much risk, you either blow up the entire system or admit that it's kind of really sort of operated by the state and allow the state to bail out the depositors. I mean, you don't have to bail out the equity holders for sure, but you certainly have to make sure that the small businesses and startups and individuals who put their money in, you know, thinking banking is safe and it's a utility and a service they need, you have to make sure that their money is safe. Otherwise, you know, the whole thing is broken. And as you say, that the main way that happens is that every so often you kind of end up collecting and sweeping up all of the smaller banks into the big ones, which become too big to fail.
Absolutely. So one thing I'm curious about is sort of how long have you been sort of working on this project, you know, as such? And also, you know, when did you start thinking about it? Would love to understand more.
Yeah, I was going to say, in a way, I've been working on it for quite a long time in that, in many ways. But, you know, sort of I started my career in finance, working in technology, you know, improving systems. And some of that is improving systems technically to make them faster and lower latency and more resilient. And some of that is trying to make them better for customers and less risky and more useful, and trying to enable and push sort of for innovation and the ability of startups to come and disrupt finance. And, you know, at a certain point in that journey, I started realizing that the model we had was broken and was not going to enable that to happen at any scale really at all. And, you know, I was sort of trying to plan my exit and figure out what to do next when, you know, Bitcoin and Ethereum came along and I got sucked into that rabbit hole, but also saw the light at the end of that tunnel and started to see that these systems, you know, through a very long journey, and it is going to be a long one given the huge vested interests and the regulatory situations and everything else. But, you know, you could start to see how there is a radically different model that solves the problems is a completely different way of thinking about solving the problems. I mean, rather than sort of stacking up regulation and capital requirements and risk management, you do things in a very different way. And I think that appealed to me. And so in 2018, we started work sort of officially. Me and my co-founder were thinking about this in 2017. But in 2018, we started work officially on the Vega project and pulled together a team and started to make the white paper and prototypes. And we've been through a good few iterations there. We've been through an incentivized test net where we've been trying things out and learning what works and what doesn't and improving things. We've been through the kind of launch of the pre-trading network, kind of like it's a bit like the the sort of pre-merge Ethereum proof of stake, which is what's running right now on mainnet. And we're maybe a few weeks away now from seeing the next code release merged to mainnet for Vega, and that will enable people to start creating markets and trading on our system. So been a long journey, and we've been working on it since 2018, but we're very close.
Yeah, no, it's terrific to hear. Obviously, this kind of longevity is something that also engenders a certain amount of trust in the industry. Just a quick disclosure note, Gumi Crypto is my fund, is actually an investor in Vega Protocol and Barney's project. So, you know, just want to make sure the audience understands that as a context for this piece. So would love to understand kind of how it's going, like what's the current status, and, you know, tell me a little bit more about how it's going and maybe some information about the testnet.
Yeah, super, super good time actually to talk about that, because it's been an incredibly exciting few months. Back in the beginning of January, we kind of cut the feature complete code release. So, we'd been doing some testing with market makers. We'd identified a few sort of product features and design elements which needed tweaking. That happened sort of in the run up to Christmas. And then beginning of the year, we sort of cut this feature complete release and started on the journey to that getting deployed and launched in mainnet. That journey kind of comes via what we call in the mainnet sims or simulations. the idea there being that we're sort of focusing the community's efforts, and that includes a community of a number of market makers and professional trading firms as well, onto testing the protocol in as realistic a situation as possible without real money. So we've set up, you know, sort of some very heavily incentivized games for the community of users. We've also engaged with, I think it's more than 10 now, funds, liquidity providing firms, market makers, other trading funds who have integrated with the APIs in the testnet, now actually running in the validated testnet as well. So fully decentralized testnet run by the same validators as the mainnet. They've been integrating with those APIs. They've been providing liquidity. The hopefully final of four sims is, I think, starts on something like Tuesday next week, which will involve a large number. Could be up to like 8 or 9 market makers or more providing liquidity on different markets, incentives for trading on that network, and really stress testing the network. As we've gone through those sims, we've taken the chance to sort of see how things perform. We've ended up actually, you know, not having too many functional issues. We had one or two early in the first sim, but we have also been looking at performance as well. So we've, you know, discovered that as people do a lot of trading, and actually as the performance of the network improves, as we've worked through some optimizations, we've been able to do so many orders a second, you know, hundreds of orders a second, on the decentralized Vega blockchain, that we've been creating huge amounts of data for the API nodes and data nodes. And that's great in that it shows the performance and capabilities of the system, but also presents a challenge for operating nodes in a sort of economical way. So we've been working on some of that, just trying to make sure that people are going to be able to run nodes in a decentralized fashion once the network launches. So that's kind of the last piece of the puzzle, hopefully. As I said, the final sim of four starts next week, and then it's Tuesday, I think. And then really from there, assuming everything goes fine in that sim and goes well, we'll basically sort of change the label on the code from pre-release to release, and notify everyone in the community, including the validators, and then they will just go and deploy that to the network. There's a few governance votes needed to kind of enable trading and create some markets, which, you know, the community will go ahead and do. As I mentioned, we're a completely decentralized chain, so we're not creating even markets there. That's actually a thing that community of market makers, market creators, and other users will do. And once those governance votes complete, you'll have Vega live and you'll have markets, and people will be able to come and trade and check it all out for real.
When do you think that will be?
That is a good question. I think it's probably going to be towards the end of April would be my best guess right now. That is with a big caveat that, you know, we're very, very cautious around like security, around like, you know, things that could cause the network to crash or issues we find. If during the simulation or at any point we discover something which we need to fix, we'll, you know, take a week out or 2 weeks as needed to fix it and make sure that gets tested. So, you know, sort of end of April, I think, is the sort of best case for trading actually beginning. But, you know, it could be a little longer than that. But we do want to make sure we get it right so that people can have a good experience on day one.
Yeah, that's very exciting, and it's still quite soon regardless. So I'm interested to get your perception about sort of the DeFi derivatives market, right? So, you know, I'm kind of curious to get your commentary on the types of products that make the most sense, you know, and you know, kind of get your estimate about sort of the size of the market. You know, what are your expectations?
It's a really interesting question. Certainly in terms of products make most sense, I think about this very much in terms of the kind of phased adoption of DeFi in general. So, you know, at the moment in crypto and DeFi, we're kind of at this point where it's very much within the community of, of crypto holders and crypto traders that most of the adoption sits. So I think the things that are going to make the most sense early are the things that those people are either familiar with or really interested in trading. So, you know, the commonly traded pairs within crypto itself, and also, we see people talking about doing things like creating futures markets on tokens that are not currently tradable, for instance, to sort of get an early futures view of that price.
Interesting.
I think we've also had funds come to us and say, we'd like to create a market, a futures market that settles on, you know, the NAV of our fund in a year's time. So effectively the community could get exposure to whether the portfolio of investments in that fund goes up or down in value. So you could kind of effectively follow a fund you like and share in their profit or loss. So I think there's some really interesting ideas like that. But all sort of initially, I think it'll all be relatively within the crypto world. Obviously, you know, Vega is a general purpose protocol. You can use stable coins to settle in stable assets, and you can then create markets on anything from the price of oil to the price of houses in Michigan or whatever you want. So I really think that's going to get super interesting as time goes on. And what I'm actually most excited about is probably that sort of second phase once you get a bit of adoption and once people start to see what the protocol can do and start doing things that are not just crypto inwardly focused, but actually demonstrate the utility of Vega and DeFi for the real world of finance. And then you asked sort of about, I guess, what was the other question? Sorry.
The size, the expected size of the market.
Yeah, that one's that's super interesting, super difficult to say. I think right now what you see is DeFi derivatives massively lagging centralized derivatives within crypto.
For sure.
But I think you see a huge number of reasons why that probably might change. The writing's on the wall for a number of sort of things that decentralized finance has been doing in order to get customers, in order to keep customers. Regulatory notice seems to be coming like thick and fast. And I think that sort of that suggests that maybe DeFi is the way to go for crypto derivatives. It suggests that to me. I think the other thing that's happening is, next generation chains, things like Vega, which is an app chain that's optimized for trading and improves on the gas and trading costs as well as the execution speed, and capital efficiency and other things. So I think what you'll find is that a larger and larger percentage of the trading with the crypto assets that in derivatives will move from centralized options to DeFi options as those DeFi options get better and the centralized options become harder and harder to operate in a compliant way. So I think that's probably where I see things going. But also you look in the crystal ball and you never know what's going to happen. At the moment, the sort of regulatory status of DeFi, it looks one way and there's things you can do and things you can't do. And we sort of understand that, but it doesn't mean that won't change as well. So it's going to be interesting to see how that all pans out over the next 6 to 12 months.
Yeah. One of the areas that I really want to double click and open up on is, some of the so-called RWA or real world assets, right? Obviously, one of the questions I would have with regards to that is sort of oracles, right? Because obviously, if you're going to do, as you mentioned, Michigan real estate, right, then you're going to actually need some way to get the actual prices, right? So I'm wondering what your perspective is on sort of oracles and also your perspective on these kind of, tradable real world scenarios.
Yeah, I mean, I think oracles is an incredibly broad topic, sort of as broad as data providers outside of crypto in a way. One thing I think is probably true is that sometimes there's a fetishization of decentralization, which isn't always helpful. So for instance, if you look at the NBA in America and you wanted an oracle for the scores of an NBA game, are you better off having a decentralized network run by random crypto users? Or are you better off trying to persuade the NBA to publish and sign the actual results of the games as they officially announce them? And in that case, it's kind of like there's an official entity. It is centralized. There is an entity that decides what the official score is. So you should go ask them, and the same with the NYSE, New York Stock Exchange. If you want to know what the closing price of something is, it's probably better to get them to sign that and say that's the closing price than to ask 600 random people on the internet to approve of that. In that case, I think there's sometimes it's a little easier. And then in other cases, there are lots of different, things like there are people like, Jump's Pith Network. There's things like, stuff going on with UMA. Then there's things like Chainlink and more decentralized Oracle options. And I think the way I see it is the best way to solve this is probably the worst way to solve this would be for us to decide what we think looks best now and hard code it into the Vega protocol and say, right, that's how you do oracles. The best way to solve it is for us to go, actually, you've got blockchains, you've got smart contracts, you've got web servers. What we're going to do is build a framework so that you can connect oracles in. So we have a framework. Initially, it's pretty basic. The first upgrade in a month or two after launch will be to connect it to the Ethereum chain. So basically, anything that can spit out data on Ethereum, you can use as an oracle for Vega. And then beyond that, we've got lots of ideas about ways to improve it to enable even more use cases, make the results safer, allow results to be validated on chain and things like that. So, but what we want to do is create a toolbox for market creators to make it really simple to connect to whatever the sort of the best answer becomes, because then you get the sort of market forces, you get the competition of everyone in this space full of very smart people trying to solve the problem as best they can. So I think that's how you get to the best answer with oracles. I'm not sure not sure we really know yet. I'm not sure many Oracle systems have been truly stress tested yet. And I think, so a lot of that's still to come. But I think, the key is enabling the innovators to be connected between their oracles and then, products and chains like Vega.
So I would say the following, right, which is that it feels like this, which it feels like effectively, the idea of a derivative is basically this concept of derivation, right, which is basically that it's a math problem based on some number, right? And presumably the number is either like a real world price or there's something, that you're deriving the asset from, right? So I guess my question to you that's kind of, is it feels like in a properly functioning market that, ideas like risk hedging, right, would be a natural function that enables derivatives to kind of more efficiently send capital, to promising projects, right? But it also seems to me that there are certain classes of derivatives that may not, have such property of market efficiency, right? So for example, you could create scenarios like futures markets where you're effectively betting on the outcome of a sports game, right? And that doesn't really, that just becomes a little more like gambling. So I'm kind of curious your perception of these two different.
It depends massively both on what you're creating the derivative on and what you're betting on, what you're taking a position on, and also how you design the product, right? So like, you can design a gambling type product, but you can design it in a way where it actually acts like a prediction market and gives you some useful information about what people expect to happen. Or you can design it in a way that it's kind of more like a sort of fun game, but doesn't really convey that much information. You can do things like binary options. You can do things, like actually markets to settle on the outcome of a score of a game. And then you can also have things that are incredibly destructive or dangerous or destabilizing. You can have things like people have proposed the ideas of things like assassination markets, where in fact someone creates a derivative that settles based on, something very bad happening and effectively allows them to create an incentive for that bad thing to happen. And, one of the reasons why Vega markets go through governance for the token holders to be approved is to sort of give the community of users and token holders and investors and owners of the Vega token the ability to kind of say, this is what we want and this is what we don't in our community, and this is what we think is good and this is what we think is bad. Because, these derivatives can be, they can be great, they can be powerful, but they can also be misleading. Like, the number of people who think that what they've done is taken a 100x leverage bet on Bitcoin. So if Bitcoin goes up in the next month, they'll make a lot of money. But if you take a 100x leverage bet on Bitcoin, what you've really done is made it almost certain that you're going to be liquidated before you get to find out whether you were right or wrong about where Bitcoin was going in the next month. So, Bitcoin might well go up in the next month. If you'd still had the 100x bet, you might be very rich. But actually what happens is the natural volatility of Bitcoin means that at some point your 100x bet has gone liquidated. So, it's very easy to make derivatives that are not useful or not as useful as they look or don't do what they seem or are just gambling, or just move money to the centralized operators of exchanges or things like Robinhood or whoever. So I think it's very important for people to understand those risks. And it's also important to try and build things into, but whether it's front ends and UXs or whether it's into governance mechanisms to try and create markets that actually have kind of economic and social use.
Yeah, it's fascinating what you said about sort of incentivization, but also the prediction value of futures markets, right? So one of the actors that was kind of widely consulted during presidential elections have been sort of futures markets, right? Because in a sense, you have kind of professional actors who are going to either make or lose money depending on, how they predict the outcome, right? So in a sense, that could be, could provide an informational function to the market, just
absolutely. And I mean, recently in the news with, with the banking stuff, every time there's new jitters, what people end up commenting on in the news is the credit default swaps, which give you an implied probability of a bank going bust. So you end up people going, oh, Deutsche Bank's credit default swaps have leapt today. Are they next? So it's kind of like, what is that telling you about the probability that they go bankrupt today as opposed to yesterday? So yeah, I think markets can be very interesting in terms of predictive properties.
Yeah, and I think that makes a ton of sense, right? Because I think your earlier case that you described is, you know, basically should winemakers be studying their banks and trying to understand their liquidity positions and their risk profile? And, you know, and obviously, you know, having these kinds of primary indicators, obviously, it's still a bit of a tall order to ask a, you know, run-of-the-mill depositor, you know, an individual person, you know, to study credit default swaps. But, you know, even so, like, there are indications and fairly clear ones, you know, as to whether there's over leverage occurring. So I think that's very interesting. I think your comment on 100x Bitcoin is definitely an interesting one, right? Because there is a segment of the market that does approximate sort of a casino. And that's
yeah,
interesting.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's interesting because that's a separate area of regulation as opposed to, you know, casinos are regulated differently from trading.
And it's very interesting when you look at front ends and UIs. Like if you go visit a trading room at a professional fund and you go look at like what some of the centralized exchanges that are more retail focused do, the first impression you'll have is that they're pretty similar. But then what you sort of realize is actually subtle cues and the things designed into the retail platforms to sort of encourage gambling, whereas the user experiences and the interfaces that are designed in professional trading houses encourage things like understanding risk, understanding exposure, understanding price levels and things. So it's kind of really interesting because they look super similar and everyone thinks they're using this pretty fancy professional interface. But actually, a lot of the time what you're doing is you're basically like a slot machine, like blinking at you, telling you to click more. Yeah,
it makes sense, actually. I've been doing a little bit of research into kind of retention and replayability kind of in the Web3 gaming side, not related at all really to any kind of like trading, but really purely related to just game and gameplay, right? And I think one of the fascinating things to turn up is really looking at things like slot machines, you know, and looking at things that have very, very high replayability through things like dopamine addiction, right? So in a sense, this idea of gamification is something that I'm sure retail exchanges and centralized exchanges like Binance have been like researching, right? Because obviously if you can increase the total volume, if you can increase the total volume by like changing a small UI element, you know, you'll absolutely go ahead and do that. So, you know, I think when you talked at the
beginning about this kind of like open source and financial system and all the stuff that you have on your website. And I think actually this is a great example of that. When you're an open source project that's kind of owned by its users and aims to be even more owned by its users and operated by its users in the future, one of the things you start to do is not have the incentive to do quite the same things. One of the things you have to do is the incentive to like build user interfaces that help your users understand their risk and help them make trading decisions that they're actually still happy with in a day or a week's time. So I think, you know, this is one of the most exciting things about DeFi and open source stuff is that the users who use it all should be on a level playing field and all should have a much better understanding of risk than perhaps they would get from a retail platform if we did this stuff right.
No, it's quite fascinating, right? Because when you look at long versus short-term incentives, right? In a sense, the short-term incentive should be to try to liquidate your users, you know, and just basically move the money from their pocket into yours, right? As an exchange, right? But obviously the thing that happens that's really interesting is when you think about the long-term incentives of your community, essentially just getting richer and richer and richer, right? So like, you know, if you imagine a long-term incentive, right, then it actually speaks more to retention, right? Because one of the fascinating things in studying exchanges and derivative exchanges is that, you know, there are certainly users who don't actually learn lessons, they just die, you know? And what I mean by that is like, if you get wiped out on, you know, the things like a short position, you know, you have potentially unlimited downside, right? So, you know, there are certain lessons that you can learn, like, you know, like instead of being like, oh, next time I'll be smarter, like, it's like, no, there isn't going to be a next time, like you're done forever, right? And those are not really great experiences, let's say.
No, absolutely. I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, I think if you look at the smart gambling platforms, the casinos and the, you know, the horse race betting and stuff, you'll find that what they have learned to do is make people have long periods where they feel like they're up and they're doing good and they're going to do okay. Like, you know, and actually give people a sort of a career being a gambler because they know that just wiping you out straight away is not a way to keep a customer. And so I think, yeah, it's certainly interesting watching how some of the interactions go with these high leverage products and the way that the people use them. But as you say, some people don't really get a chance to have a second go and not make the mistakes they made the first time.
Yeah, that's interesting and dangerous stuff. So I'm very, and it sort of really relates to the extractive mindset and paradigm of, you know, not only centralized finance, but really Web2 and centralized systems in general, right? So if you start to see all the externalities that have popped up on social media, right, that's a purely extractive phenomenon, you know, and I think absolutely. We're seeing effectively sort of almost like a rage farming mentality arising, you know, which really is, you know, not, it's not a healthy or balanced system. So yeah, I guess you
exploit psychology for attention, turn the attention into clicks and users, get them to put their money in, effectively make them lose it all to you. And then you just keep rinse and repeat. And that's
very similar economic leverage. Yeah. Web two is, I think we're kind of getting good and done with Web2. So I guess one of the questions that I would have probably on behalf of the audience is really focusing on some of the differentiations that you've built into the protocol. So like, you know, what's novel here? What are the mechanisms? You know, what makes it tick? Like what's your special advantage and secret sauce?
Yeah, there were a few things. The first one, I guess, we built an app-specific chain. So rather than having kind of like, you know, something like Ethereum where there's a gas cost for everything, we actually, you know, the majority of what funds the network comes through trading fees. So when you actually access and take liquidity, you pay for that like on a centralized exchange, actually. But what that enables is no gas and no fee to place orders. That's super important because the orders and price levels on an order book are how the market learns what the market price for something is. So you really don't want to create friction to providing that data. So people placing orders provide that data for free, and we don't charge them to do that in terms of the protocol. Another thing that we have done is sort of built market protections in. So this is something I'm really super surprised that not many centralized crypto exchanges do, but most centralized other exchanges and markets have sort of price protections. So if someone does a fat finger error or some bots and algos start trading against each other and move the price really quickly for no good reason, then they'll tend to do something to arrest that. So the Vega protocol is actually designed to be able to enter a sort of protective auction when the price moves a lot in a short space of time. This doesn't actually stop the price moving. It means that the market has the opportunity to look at that auction and look at the price and kind of place their orders and decide where the price is before any of the trades are printed. So instead of allowing a massive swing to happen because of a fat fingered error, you have a protective auction. Everyone places their prices. If the massive swing was actually a real valid change in the price, the auction is going to close at that price and the price is going to move. But if it was some kind of fat finger error or other issue or flash crash, then actually rather than causing a bunch of people to get wiped out and lose money, people will come in with their sort of counter orders and the price will end the auction at the right price. So that just enables a little bit more market safety and a little bit less of the crazy volatility due to those sorts of issues. So those are two of the things we've done. And there's lots and lots of small things where we've really been focused on optimizing for products that could, you know, eventually actually take some of the volume that's being done on, you know, traditional finance. And so, you know, looking at how derivative products actually need to work and how settlement should work and capital efficiency and everything like that. But those are just a couple of the things that we've done to make Vega the sort of best sort of decentralized place to do derivatives.
Yeah, that's very exciting. I think in particular, the market safety construct is pretty important. I don't know if people realize, but you know, there are these kind of security switches in things like the NASDAQ exchange, you know, so if you do see kind of this extremely aberrant types of behavior in the market, you know, there are protective mechanisms. So, you know, it's certainly not a completely unfamiliar concept, but I think it's also exceedingly valuable, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very valuable. And I think, you know, one of the things that you sort of wonder with centralized exchanges where every time they sort of blow up, it turns out they were all allowing their friends to trade for free and giving them all these benefits is actually, you know, how much is it that there's some insiders benefiting from those flash crashes and the lack of those protections at the, you know, at the cost of the users. And certainly, you know, building those protections into decentralized markets is really important.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think one of the dastardly things that's very complex, right, is really this kind of like balancing force between OTC market, which is kind of largely dark, right? And then the public exchange markets, which are kind of like not dark, right? And so the thing that I think is really interesting is that, you know, large things like large sell orders on centralized exchanges, like the economics don't make sense, right? Because if you put a large sell order, the price is going to slide in the process of fulfilling the order, right? So you're not actually getting a good price, you're actually getting a bad price, right? So anyone who's kind of making things like a large sell order on a public exchange is sort of deliberately doing it to smash the price, you know, and possibly buy OTC after that, you know. And the other thing is true, the converse is also true, right? Which is that a large buy order, you know, doesn't get fulfilled at a logical price, right? So in a sense, if you're going to do a large order, right, you should do it in a way that you get a fixed price, like you would in over the counter, right? Whereas like, to me, like there's dastardly things going on, right? People are, you know, anyone who's selling really big orders on an exchange or vice versa, you know, is doing something that's irrational. And it feels like people with large sums of money don't do like wildly irrational things. Totally, right? So yeah. it's you know, it's, you can infer that something shady is going on, right? And that's,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, that's
very undesirable.
Depending on where the liquidity sits in a market, like sometimes your large orders will happen OTC and sometimes they will happen on an exchange. When they happen on an exchange, they tend to happen in a very algorithmic way. You know, you'll have a multiple, you know, time horizon, multiple hours, multiple days even. You'll have algorithms that split the order up into small parts to minimize price impact. You'll be looking for the opportunities to trade at a price. Like when you see someone just dump a huge amount somewhere or try and buy a huge amount, you know, you've always got to ask the question, like who's going to benefit from the price changing that much that quickly?
Definitely nefarious deeds. So, you know, I definitely think that's fascinating to see. So I guess one of the questions for me, you know, is how do you see sort of the long-term future, you know, especially in regards to the state of derivatives, you know, and the state of the market in general, DeFi?
It's a good question. I think, you know, we're very much, as I sort of said before, like the number of proven use cases for derivatives in crypto and derivatives settling in crypto assets is way smaller than the number of proven use cases for derivatives globally. Like right now it's kind of,
yes,
for people, sure, in crypto who are trading, you know, some of them are retail, some are hedge funds, some of them, you know, have long-term views. But really it's just that. Whereas, you know, derivatives in the real world are used to hedge, you know, real world things like the price of gasoline or, you know, the difference between two currencies. And there are some crypto specific additional similar use cases that you can think of, like, you know, the Ethereum gas price, like how much does it cost to run my smart contract operations on Ethereum? Maybe I want to hedge that. So I think, you know, the sort of way that I see it evolving is we have to demonstrate that we actually can build protocols and systems that are as good. You know, that means they're as capital efficient, that means they're as safe, that means that they have, you know, reasonably low latency, that means that they have good and trustworthy settlement, etc., to operate real markets. And that will take time. You know, even if Vega out of the bat was ready to do that with no issues at all, and that's unlikely to be true, there are likely to be issues early on in Vega's alpha mainnet once it goes live, but even if that was true, no issues at all, you know, look at how long it took Bitcoin and Ethereum to go from beta software that you maybe like should be cautious with to something that is just operating day in, day out and that you now trust. But that's where we want to get to. We want to make this stuff boring. We actually want to get to the point where whether or not the system is going to settle correctly or whether or not the platform is going to work and the market protection mechanisms are going to work and all of those things are going to work okay, that needs to become unbelievably boring and unbelievably just expected. And, you know, lots of eyes on that and lots of time and experience, you know, over the next year or two and more will be what does that. But as that starts to happen, I think you'll start to see other things in the industry coalesce as well. You know, wallets and custodians and everything, stable coins, how those things interact with the rest of the system. And then you start to get to a point where you could imagine, you know, maybe a small business owner who imports and exports, you know, imports from, say, Europe to the US, their bank offers them some horrendously bad deal with a huge spread on hedging their euro exposure, but there's a decentralized marketplace where actually super liquid, very low spreads, they can access it with the same price as anyone else. And so they actually start to you know, use that market to hedge their euro exposure and maybe get a price that's 20, 30, 40% better, which has a measurably beneficial impact on their business. So I think, you know, that's where we need to get to and want to get to over the next few years. But you know, it's one step at a time. We first got to prove that this stuff can be made to be very secure and trusted. And anyone who thinks that that's impossible and points at all the DeFi blowups, I would point them at Linux, the operating system, which didn't even have the economic incentives that DeFi has. Because on day one, Linux was like, this is a toy. No one should ever use this for anything. It's like one guy in his bedroom. It's a university. It's just a toy operating system. And now most of the internet runs on it. And it just proves that when you've got all the eyes on it, when you've got open code and open data, and when there's an incentive for people to come together and build something really robust and good, they can go do it. And I think crypto and Web3 actually adds better incentives and better alignment for making that stuff happen faster. So, you know, I would expect, you know, maybe nearly an order of magnitude faster getting to that point for Web3 tech than perhaps it took Linux. But I think the same trajectory is the one we'll see.
Yeah, I think what you just said is kind of one of the reasons why we're so well aligned and why it's always such a delight to speak with you. You know, I think, you know, I go back a little ways in Silicon Valley through open source software, you know, and I actually watched the gradual battle of Linux inside of Microsoft, right? So in the early days of Microsoft with Steve Ballmer, you know, he was definitely in favor of running Microsoft Azure Cloud on top of Windows NT, right? So they had their own version of Windows that they ran in their cloud, you know, and eventually what happened was, of course, that Linux took over, right? So, you know, it's exactly as you say, right, which is that, you know, better software wins, right? And open software ends up being more secure, and it ends up being faster, and it ends up just being, it has so many contributors, right? That, and so many vested interests, right? So now Microsoft is a net contributor to Linux, right? They're, you know, they're sending patches in, they're saying, oh, you know, we fixed something for you, you know, so everybody's now aligned, right? And they're,
this
they're
is where all, it snowballs,
the whole
right?
world.
Because every large company ends up dependent on it. And so now every large company wants to donate to someone who maintains it, or they want to hire some developers and have them working for, you know, Microsoft and IBM and Google are working side by side on the Linux kernel because they all depend on it now. You know, how else do you get them to work together? Like nowhere else are you going to get them to work together, but you know, you do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So they absolutely desperately want to make sure that it's the most secure. And one of the things that happened in the early days of open source software is people would argue that it can't possibly be secure because the hackers are seeing the source code, right? And it turns out that it's more secure, right? Because, you know, just a much, much larger number of people are able to see any of the flaws, right? So, you know, you missed the spot there, right? So, oh, okay, I fixed it for you, you know? So there's a lot of like really, really important principles that relate to kind of how open source software eventually just flat wins, right? Like it's just it's super simple, right? It just wins by being better, right? It's just a superior software. So why would you use inferior software? It just doesn't work. Even if you're going to pay money for it, like you're going to pay money for inferior software, right? So that's clearly like open source is always the winner in that case.
Yeah. And it's amazing how many times that gets proven to be true. And it sort of never fails to fascinate me how many times people will find arguments for their some other way that it's going to be. But I think in the long term, you know, the value of, you know, software is free to copy things. You know, copying bytes to other bytes doesn't cost any money. So the long term, the value of building things that we all share and can sort of infinitely copy and use to build on top of is just outstrips the sort of build it for your proprietary benefit and commercial benefit and keep it to yourself mentality in the long run every time.
Yeah, that's very exciting and it's very aligning. I'm quite excited. One of the things that I'm quite curious about, though, when I think about market structuring, right, is that there is a really exciting potential for things like real world asset derivative markets, right? Because one of the things that I think the pure crypto derivatives market suffer from is kind of in some ways a lack of fundamentals, right? Like, for example, if you think about commodities derivatives, right, you can do things like you can hedge weather patterns, you know, so you can do lots of really, really, really sophisticated risk hedging, you know, where you can say, okay, well, what's the impact of, you know, the weather patterns in Florida on oranges, you know, so you can basically make these very, very elaborate trades, right? Whereas like, in some cases in pure crypto, there's sort of a lack of fundamentals, right? So in a sense, like there's so much kind of wild speculation.
Yeah, it's more meme patterns than weather patterns.
Yes, exactly. Now, obviously, like there are probably extremely sophisticated actors that are trying to hedge meme patterns, you know, but I feel like, you know, that gets to be a little bit, you know, nonsensical after a point, right? So, you know, I guess what are your perspectives? You know, I believe that there's potentially a large market for cybersecurity based sort of derivatives, you know. So I think, you know, obviously we would need to have sophisticated oracles on kind of cybersecurity events, right? And defining them, right? Because you wouldn't. So in a sense, these might operate more like futures markets, but I think from a financial product perspective, they might operate more like insurance. So I'm curious your perspective.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, the market versus insurance thing is really, is actually really just about liquidity, right? You know, an insurance policy is just an extremely complex derivative with like no liquidity. So, you know, instead of having an exchange, what you do is you define this derivative with your insurer, and they basically buy the other side of the trade and just warehouse the risk and manage it, right? So it is just an incredibly illiquid derivative. And obviously what they do is they put it with a lot of similar ones, and it's basically like building a mortgage-backed security. Like every mortgage is a little different, but the MBS is kind of tradable. And it's kind of like, this is what, you know, your car insurance company does. They have many insurance policies that are similar enough that they can imagine that they're all roughly the average, and then they can think reason about them as a sort of market. So I think, you know, insurance and derivatives are sort of two sides of the same coin. I do agree that there's loads of really exciting things to do, and there are two reasons why DeFi is going to nail this in a way that traditional markets couldn't. The first one is bringing innovation closer to the need. So if you want to build derivatives or even insurance products, you basically need to be in one of like 5 or 6 cities on Earth, maybe. You need to have a huge amount of money, you need to be connected to the markets, you need to find all of these things. And you know, the guys sat in Hong Kong designing derivatives there, they probably don't know what things the farmers in rural China actually need to hedge. They probably don't really know. They're going to build something close-ish, and then all the farmers in all of China will trade the close-ish thing, wishing they had a slightly better product. But they're not going to have what they want. And this is the same with your cybersecurity stuff as well. You know, even if JP Morgan built a cybersecurity derivative, would it really be a derivative that understood the nuances of the difference between the cybersecurity market for defense companies in Russia versus Silicon Valley tech companies versus Chinese tech companies? Like, of course not. They're not close enough. So that's the first thing DeFi does, is it lets the people right close to it go build that product and say, right, we're here, we have access to the code, we can see how other derivatives have been built, we can customize this, we can ask people questions online, we can put it out there as a prototype for very little cost, and we can iterate it and make it really good and make it really fit for purpose for this specific market. The other thing that enables that is like things like automated passive or semi-passive liquidity provision. So on exchanges, and you know, the New York Stock Exchange or the London Stock Exchange or other big exchanges, CME, wherever, you have market makers moving huge amounts of money. You have very intensive processes to manage algorithms and provide liquidity. We are starting to build things, you know, like AMMs and stuff. And, you know, they get a bad rap. And I will often, you know, be part of that to say, I don't think AMM liquidity is anywhere near as efficient as liquidity on order books when you have a very liquid market, when you have a lot of trading demand. Because with a lot of trading demand, the value of having one or two people manage some algorithms and getting it really right and getting really good pricing is very high. But if you have a new product that's a prototype that's only going to be applicable to, you know, a few counties in one part of the US, that product does not justify someone on 250K a year plus bonus, plus all their computers and screens and microwave connections between exchanges and all of that stuff, doesn't justify that for making it just a little bit more liquid. What it does justify is things like AMM curves providing that bootstrap liquidity. So I think you combine that ability to do open source code, copy code, build and prototype and iterate the product with the ability to bootstrap liquidity with just a small amount of capital and put it into something like an AMM. That allows the market to get going. And maybe it stays a small market with just AMMs or little, you know, request for quote style markets. Or maybe it starts to grow and then maybe liquidity providers with order books and algorithms come in later. But I think, you know, that iterative approach to building the product and that ability to bootstrap liquidity very cheaply means Cambrian explosion of new markets, means innovation right where the need is, means much better suited products for the markets. And that stuff is super exciting because nothing in traditional finance is ready for that. No one understands what it'll mean when people are able to do that.
Yeah, and it really is wonderful, right? Because to me, like what you're describing when you're describing things like farmers in China, right, is that you're really describing kind of making a fundamentally unreliable world, you know, that much more reliable, right? So you can make something financially reliable really by finding risk counterparties, right? So that becomes, you know, something where you just have more equitable, you know, risk absorption, right? So that, you know, because I think one of the things that characterizes insurance is sort of an unacceptable risk, right? Which is sort of, okay, if that happens, we're dead, right? And, you know, if you look at kind of financial products like insurance from that perspective, you know, that is unacceptable, right? Like, it's like, that's more than any organization should have to bear, right? So in a sense, like, you know, if you could mitigate that, you know, through kind of some kind of a derivatives-based mechanism.
And I think, then you know,
it makes the life easier.
One of the massive benefits of the kind of internet and tech-driven startup boom is the fact that you don't have to do very many things, right? So like even in the early dot-com 2000s, it was like you had to learn to do servers and data centers and Oracle databases. And now you're kind of like, okay, I can use this cloud service. I can, you know, the number of things I have to do to launch a product or an app or sell something online is really small. And the benefit there is like, I can be really good at two things and I can know something about the world that no one else knows. And I can start a business and just go at it and create Airbnb or Uber or whatever. And that's really, really wonderful. And I think derivatives accessible for everyone is a similar thing. It's kind of like, I don't want to be good at predicting the price of gasoline. I don't want to be good at predicting the weather next week. I know like these three things about my business area, about this thing that I'm very passionate about. I can go build that business and I can farm out just the same as you farm out running servers to Google or Amazon. I can farm out knowing those things to the people who want to be experts at that. And then I can go build the thing that I'm good at. And I think, you know, that sort of unbundling of things that you're good at and you want to do from things that you don't want to do and you don't want to take risk on is, you know, really fundamental to enabling kind of more and more people to create businesses and better and more efficient businesses and all of the benefits that come with that.
Yeah, I'm delighted to hear this, right? Because from my perspective, one of the absolute critical factors that kind of brings us full circle back to the beginning of our conversation, right, is the idea that when you really lower the cost of participation, right, that this radical drop in the cost of participation really creates innovation, right? Because you just have much, much wider diversity of participants, you know, and you have kind of never before existent participants, right? So in a sense, this kind of idea that open source is the platform for human innovation, right? And that the bar continues to rise, right? And so in a sense, what happens is that the developers of today are effectively standing on the shoulders of the giants of yesterday, right? So, you know, I do think, you know, as you see the, you know, one way of looking at open source is the total history of all software that has ever worked, right? So it's a fossil record or it's a conserved DNA of everything that works, right? So, you know, if it works, it's there, right? And so, you know, as this stuff accretes and gets more and more and more powerful, you know, the ease of use and applications become more and more facile. So, you know, I think, you know, I love that it is a builder vision and it's also kind of a fundamentally, you know, more optimistic vision, you know, of the world, because that's really kind of, I think you said trust but verify. I have a kind of a broader axiom that I call hope, but do the work, right? And that's kind of a similar mental model.
I think that's great, and I think, you know, the key thing about that is like, the more you increase the like surface area of humanity that has the tools and ability to do the work, the more likely we are to get the best results out of the work. Like, you know, if you want to solve climate change, you want everyone on earth to be as educated as possible. You want everyone on earth to be able to live a reasonable life and afford to eat and, you know, survive. And then you want to give them all these open source tools and go, if you can help solve this problem, if you can come up with something, you know, we're listening, you can do it, you have the tools, and also you have an economic incentive to do that. So actually, you know, doing that work is valuable.
Yeah, that is a absolutely wonderful vision. I do think that, what we're touching upon is the idea that since open source is a marketplace of essentially it's a marketplace of consent, right? So the thing that happens that you're describing is that closing an externality like pollution or carbon pollution, that if you close an externality, you're basically just what happens is open source sees economic externalities as opportunity, right? It's just an opportunity for a new product, that'll help a larger group of people. So, definitely
Absolutely.
exciting times. So how can they follow you, and how can they follow the project, and how can audience members learn more about what you're working on?
So Vega.xyz on the web, we have Discord where a lot of our community members hang out and talk about what's going on in the project and research and ideas. I am at Barnaby with two E's on Twitter, and Vega's at Vega Protocol on Twitter. So yeah, all those ways to follow us.
Yeah, fantastic. So, really, really appreciate you joining. Absolutely brilliant and exciting vision. And it's wonderful to see. Really, really. As soon as possibly April. You didn't hard commit, but we're gonna see. Mainnet quite soon here. So I think it's that's very bracing and exciting.
Yeah, super exciting. And apologies that we can't hard commit, but it is down to the community in some ways as well. And so it will be as soon as it can. And I'm massively looking forward to it. I think everyone on the team
Yeah, no,
is, and
it's
everyone in the community is. So yeah.
no, and it's been a tremendous and Herculean road, long journey, and lots of incredibly hard work. So, it's definitely a fun project to watch. So, instead of kind of having a hard commit date, please do join the community and, be a close watcher. You'll be able to see the correct dates coming out, through your participation and direct participation in governance and in the community, over on the Discord or, wherever else, you may find. So,
Absolutely.
really enjoyed it.
Yeah, absolutely. Me too. And feel free to reach out on Discord or Twitter, and I will try and respond if anyone has questions or wants to get in touch.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.